This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:04 in the evening, and our first story is a plan on how to address all the food going to waste in the state.
Food production is the single biggest cause of deforestation, water extraction, biodiversity loss.
More and more people are concerned about climate change, and one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gases is the food that they're throwing away.
We are literally taking food out of the mouths of the hungry and sending food waste into landfill.
So on that very dramatic note, we talk a lot about food waste and how best to go about fixing this. And one suggestion that has, of course, come up from time to time has been contributing waste to food banks.
Now, Federal Territories Minister Khalid Samad is suggesting that there might be a special facility in the Selayang wholesale market that would facilitate contributions from traders to the food bank program in KL. This would cover items that have been set aside specifically to go to the food bank, as well as items that are surplus and unsold. Khalid went on to say that this facility would also be open for people who just wanted to contribute food for the needy, so long as the food items are of good quality and safe to eat.
So here I think we're getting into a little bit of an issue that comes up whenever we talk about giving items to, charity. And I'm using the word loosely, I'm using the word with the air quotes here, because you do find that there have been, while it's always welcome, of course, you know, people wanting to contribute, it's important, it's a good thing. I think there have also traditionally been people who have not exactly been putting their best foot forward in terms of giving these items away. I think you find sometimes that the clothes that are given are just unwearable, you know, or that food that is given is really of questionable origin.
Yeah.
And so I think it's good that there's going to be a facility that's actually going to sort these things out. I think it's good that there's a place that people know, okay, I can go there. That is the place I can go in order to contribute to the food bank. And I'm just hoping that when those items are set aside or given away, that they are, you know, good quality and safe to eat. I worry sometimes that it's subjective.
Yeah, it definitely is. I think the problem with food banks sometimes is that the food that they get is not of high nutrition. So I volunteered at a food bank, I think, when I was doing an exchange program in the States, and a lot of the products were very high in salt and very high in sugar. So they would, I mean, this is because of the nature of the food itself, where it can be stored for a very long time. So it was a lot of instant food, there were a lot of canned soups, there were also a lot of dry biscuits that I think were sugared or heavily salted ones as well. So in that sense, it's not super nutritious. And I think that problem is probably reflected here as well.
It's entirely safe to eat, right?
Yes.
That's the thing. So, I mean, if we break down the points about good quality, safe to eat, I think, is pretty much a non-issue. But quality becomes, questionable, I think. And also, if you're talking about surplus, then we're looking at issues like shelf life. I do think overall, I don't mean to sound like we're dinging it. I think that it is a great solution for food waste, just that if you are going to be providing it, then yeah, I mean, let's ensure that the food is actually good and safe to eat. So in case you haven't heard about the Food Bank Malaysia program, here's Minister of Domestic Affairs and Consumerism, Saifuddin Nasution Ismail, explaining on Astro Awani how it works.
Ianya adalah satu program di mana kita usahakan mengumpul lebihan makanan atau food surplus dari sumber. Sumbernya boleh jadi dapur hotel, hypermarkets, supermarkets, restoran. Lebihan makanan yang masih elok, masih selamat untuk dimakan. Kemudian diagihkan kepada kumpulan penerima. Boleh jadi ibu tunggal, boleh jadi orang kurang, orang kelainan upaya, boleh jadi anak yatim, boleh jadi sekolah-sekolah, asrama-asrama, boleh jadi juga apa yang tadi disebut oleh Kamarul sebagai kumpulan bottom 40.
Ya.
Kemudian satu lagi rukun, setelah ada penyumbang dan ada penerima, mesti ada pihak yang nak mengusahakannya, iaitu menguruskannya, menyelaraskannya, mengendalikannya. Dan pihak yang menyelaras dan mengendali ini buat secara sukarela. Maknanya tak ada melibatkan kos.
Yeah.
Dan itulah maksudnya program Food Bank yang saya istilahkan sebagai Food Bank Malaysia. So kalau kita tengok balik falsafah ini, memberi makan orang miskin itu ada kesannya dari sudut kerohaniannya. Itu falsafahnya. Jadi saya berpendapat inisiatif ini adalah inisiatif yang kalau diusahakan dengan kemas tersusun, kata Kamaru tadi, impactnya insya Allah akan begitu luar biasa.
So that was Minister of Domestic Trade and Consumer Affairs Saifuddin Nasution Ismail talking about the Food Bank Malaysia program. Let us know what you think of this. Would you go and contribute to this food bank? Again, it's actually going to be taking place. There's going to be a special facility in the Selayang wholesale market, so traders can participate, but also the general public, if they wanted to, could drop by and contribute if you wanted it to go to Food Bank Malaysia. I mean, do you agree that food wastage is a big problem? What incidences have you seen? We'd love to hear. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We received this message here from Farid, who talks about a story that occurred in Germany, where basically they noticed that people there were eating less, basically. People there were eating only what they... I guess everybody had one main meal, one drink, for example, and they were finishing everything. And in comparison, they were ordering lots and lots of food, yeah. I guess, because they were entertaining. And in the end, there was still about a third of unconsumed food on the table. And when they were leaving the restaurant, they were actually spoken to by the other patrons saying like, hey, why did you waste so much food? And all of that ended up with them being issued a 50 euro fine from a social security organization, because the idea here is order only what you can consume. The money is yours, but resources belong to society. And which is an interesting point.
Yeah, I think that's not something we think about, because the moment we buy something, in this case, I think with food, we think it's ours. It's how we use it. It's how we decide to, I guess, throw it away at the end of the day.
Yes, that's the thing. But it is, of course, a huge problem. So talk to us about food wastage. You can WhatsApp, again, that number 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, moving on to our next story. When we think about public and televised political debates, this is, you know, usually what comes to mind.
Around with crocodile tears about how terrible it is, but he has given jobs to Chinese steel workers, not American steel workers.
Mr. Trump?
That's the kind
of approach
not going to work. We're going to pull the country together. We're going to have trade agreements that we enforce. That's why I'm going to have a trade prosecutor for the first time in history.
I ask a simple question. She's been doing this for 30 years. Why the hell didn't you do it over the last 15, 20 years? You were very much involved in every aspect of this country, very much. And you do have experience. I'd say the one thing you have over me is experience, but it's bad experience, because what you've done has turned out badly.
So when presidential elections in the States roll around, the public debates are somewhat of a highlight for the voters and, I guess, for the rest of the world. Over here, it's a pretty non-existent practice, but history was just made last night when candidates in Cameron Highlands took to the podium to debate each other in Malaysia's first ever televised political debate.
Now, having said that, turnout wasn't amazing. Only about 50 people showed up. And according to reports on the ground, about half of the folks who turned up were either media or policemen in plain clothes. And this low voter turnout is a stark contrast from the usual numbers that make up, you know, we've seen them, the ceramahs hosted by Barisan Nasional or Pakatan Harapan or the Pakatan Harapan Coalition. And when moderator Faizal S. Haziz took questions from the floor, only a few voters really kind of put their hand up.
But despite the low turnout, most people were happy to see the debate take place. Former Islamic Development Department, JAKIM officer Mohammad Tahir, said the debate was a welcome change in electoral practices and brought the country closer to practices abroad. He said that having the candidates debate each other is good. It will have an effect on voters.
Pediatrician Dr. Chiam Mei Chu actually raised another point, saying that this public debate stage helps to level the playing field for independent candidates who don't necessarily possess, you know, the backing of that big party machine. And he was actually there to get to know the candidates better. And as we mentioned, political debates, we've seen very much part of the elections in the United States, often used as a measure of democracy. Here's Professor Michael Heaney from the University of Michigan with a little explainer on political debates.
The presidential political debates are one of the great traditions in American politics. Actually, the debates are not required either by law or by the Constitution. Rather, they're just something that we do as part of the process of educating voters about who the candidates are. In the first presidential debate between President Barack Obama and challenger former Governor Mitt Romney, the debate may have provided some real insight into the personalities of these candidates. Mitt Romney appeared very buoyant and very energetic and combative, whereas President Obama appeared more subdued and less energetic. It's unclear as to whether or not this will make a difference in the election. However, it did provide insight into the difference between these two candidates and their personalities. So what difference do the presidential debates make? Can they affect the outcome of an election? The answer is both yes and no. Sometimes they do, but often they don't. A reasonable guess is that about 20% of the time, it seems that the presidential debates do make a difference. The 1960 presidential debate and the 2000 presidential debate are probably the best examples of debates that really did seem to matter. In 1960, Nixon's older, more tired appearance and Kennedy's more youthful approach seemed to have made a difference in a very close election. In the 2000 presidential contest between George W. Bush and Al Gore, Al Gore's very bombastic style during the debates and rudeness in interrupting both his opponent, George W. Bush, and the moderator reflected very poorly on him and probably hurt him severely with swing voters during the election. The debates are not always as issue-oriented as we'd like them to be, but when they do touch on issues, they can help with informing voters about who the presidential candidates are and what they stand for in the presidential election. The debates help to point out to us that this is a real area of difference and something that we should be paying attention to when we're deciding which of the two parties to vote for.
So back to Cameron Highlands, Bursay organized the debate, and its showrunner, Thomas Phan, said he wasn't disappointed by the turnout because history was made. He says it's a good start and that he hopes debates will become the norm for all future general elections and by-elections.
So for what it's worth, all the candidates were present except BN's Ramli Mohammed Noor. And I am not super surprised at the fact that there isn't a high turnout for this. I think people are used to a more sort of drama style of delivering the message. You know, it's always a little bit fiery. There's lots and lots of people. And it's part of what we've become used to. I'm not saying that a debate is a bad thing, just that perhaps it's not something that people necessarily know how to expect the way that it's expected and, you know it's going to happen in other parts of the world.
I also wonder if it's tied into our culture and voting, because once we vote for a certain party, we tend to stick with that for the rest of our life. So maybe that's why the reception towards charamas are so big compared to this debate, right? Because, well, why am I interested in what the other person has to say?
Yeah, so in charamas, you end up preaching to the choir, definitely. I think a debate's a great idea. I think that it is actually a good way to hear somebody's views get challenged.
Yep.
And you also get to listen to what they'll be like under pressure, which is an important trait, right, that you would want the person representing you to have. So I think a debate is perfectly sound. The only thing is just, how are we going to get that viewership up, right? It's just the first time. Let us know. I mean, do you think that voters are going to get used to the debate format versus the charama format when it comes to elections? Is this going to be the new norm? We'd like to hear from you. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Andrew says, not the first political debate in Malaysia. Anwar debated Shabri. I think Lim Guan Eng may have done one too. I think the history being referred to here is that it is the first for an election. First debate involving candidates who are going head-to-head in an election. I could be wrong, but this is what's being reported, and this is also what Thomas Phan has said. But you can let us know. Again, that number to WhatsApp, 018-789-8899, and you can tweet us at BFM Radio. And we're going to be taking a little break and then coming back to talk about how city planning might be linked to mental health. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Building Fit Malaysians, BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition with Lynn and Calvin. We are talking about food wastage and the food bank program. We are also discussing whether or not we're ever kind of going to get used to political debates being the norm as opposed to more charama style preaching to the choir, telling you everything that you kind of maybe already know. You know, do we want to hear debates? Do we want to hear more challenges and confrontation? Let us know. WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio, like Emacs. Macro, who says for some reason the Chinese are notorious for food wastage. In China, if you don't order 7 or 9 dishes at restaurants, you're offending your guests, and it ends up in food wastage. It's nothing to be proud of. It's something to be ashamed of.
You know, coming up to, we're very close to Chinese New Year, and I think this is the trend that we see often in, because now the trend is to eat out, so you can see on dining tables that the dishes that we order are wide varieties, and we order a lot of them, despite not everyone eating everything. The good thing about my family is that while we do order a lot, we take it home. We tap out if we don't manage to finish it. I don't know if that goes across for all families.
It's a culture of abundance, right? Yeah. The idea that, hey, look, we can do this, you
prosperity.
Know. Prosperity. Prosperity for the next year. And so, and that ends up, of course, because prosperity comes up against the limits of people's stomachs, and then you just don't have enough room. Margaret says, hopefully you can get hold of a spokesperson from the Lost Food Project in KL. Thanks for the tip, Margaret. They are making solid progress, but funding for logistics is always a challenge.
It's also interesting to point out that some of these NGOs are also more actively involved in policy making. For example, the Food Aid Foundation, they are actively trying to create a policy where hotels and restaurants, where the unfinished food, the unfinished unsold food can be given to food banks or can be given out on the streets for people to eat as well.
And moving on then to our next story. Before we start, though, if you are out and about or perhaps in an office with windows, if I could just ask you to take a quick look around you, and I'll let you know why I'm curious about that in just a moment.
When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city.
I love that song. So we read this story on Quartz.com, which posits that cities actually have an impact on the mental health of the people living in it. And that's why I asked you to look around, because I guess the big question then is, how does KL actually fare in this respect in terms of affecting the mental health of the people who are KLites?
So from as far back as the late 19th century, urban planning was focused on the health and well-being of city dwellers. There was a lot to deal with at the time. Of course, diseases like typhoid and cholera used to be endemic, which is why we have things like sewage systems and garbage collections. In the modern age, though, urban planning plays a role in addressing chronic diseases, since so much of your lifestyle depends on where you live. Things like how much you walk and drive, your ability to cycle, whether you work a sedentary office-based job. And now we're starting to consider mental health as well.
So when this question came up at the 2016 World Health Organization Global Health Promotion, that is a long conference title, conference in Shanghai, most public health and city planning professionals hadn't actually considered how to address mental health at the level of the population. I mean, it doesn't help that, of course, there's also stigma attached, which makes it harder for city planners to go ahead and address the mental health issue.
So here is urban experimentalist Charles Montgomery speaking about why mental health should be a focus in urban planning.
And in the course of my research, I found that the most important ingredient of human happiness is social connections. So the happy city is a social city above all. Now, how important are social connections? Well, the economist John Helliwell compared life satisfaction, which is a measure of happiness, with reported trust in neighbors in cities across Canada. And what he found was a very strong correlation. Basically, the more people said they trusted their neighbors, the happier people in that city said they were. People who are socially connected are more resilient. They get through hard times more easily. They get over illness more quickly. They live longer, an average of 15 years longer than people who are disconnected. They're more productive at work. In fact, social trust, social connections correlate really strongly with economic growth. So if we care about having a happy, resilient, healthy, and wealthy society, we really should care about building social connections. And I use that word building on purpose because I also discovered that the systems and forms of our cities influence how we feel and how we treat each other.
So there are potentially a few ways to do this. One of them is, you know, to expand access to green spaces, things like parks, trees by the road, even views of nature through the office window, which is something that thankfully we sort of have. You know, they've been shown to benefit mental health.
So the next suggestion isn't new either. We know physical activity benefits the body, but it can also help to address forms of mild depression, anxiety, symptoms of dementia, and even ADHD and schizophrenia. So walking circuits in parks or safe cycling infrastructure could go a long way in promoting mental health.
Another thing that could be done in cities is to kind of create these pockets to encourage positive social interaction, which is, of course, key to increasing self-esteem, preventing loneliness. Here, we're talking about public spaces installing features like benches and chess tables to facilitate social interaction and provide avenues for community activities. And I think here in KL, we're starting to see little pockets of that. It's not something that I think was first and foremost in our urban planning. And of course, the weather has a big part to do with that also.
Yeah, I don't think our cities actually planned out very well in that sense, because you find that the way the city has grown has been a bit messy, and if not the more polite, pleasant way to say it, it has been quite organic, where you have really, really tall buildings, and in the middle of these two corporate buildings, you suddenly have a temple.
Yeah, no, that's true. But that's part of the charm, I think.
Yes, it is.
But with that said, I mean, I do find myself, certain cities get me down, to be honest. Right. And these are cities that actually have great urban planning. It's nothing to do with that. But for example, Singapore, I get entirely peopled out, and it's got nothing. I'm not making a dig on Singaporeans. I could, but I won't. Instead, it's much more to do with the fact that just after a whole day of standing in lines, in very orderly lines, to get into trains with lots of other people, to go eat in restaurants with lots of other people, to line up for public restrooms, you know, just all of it eventually just has me feeling incredibly peopled out. And I mean, it's a very well laid out city. Doesn't change the fact that when I'm there, I can't really stay in Singapore for any longer than 3 days without starting to feel, oh, I need space.
So it's strange that you say that, because some people actually like the systemic way they're living. So I guess for some people, what they find disturbing is the fact that you get into a line, you get into another line, and then you get to another line, and then you get home in a small, cramped little birdcage of an apartment.
Yeah, it's different, right? And I find it interesting addressing this particularly with you, because you are such a city kid. I mean, you've said it many times that you would never want to, you're not interested in leaving the city. You're not interested in, you know, kind of slowing down your pace of life. This is how you like it.
Yeah, that's true. And I still continue to say that despite the fact that commuting around KL is very difficult. The longer I spend in my car, the longer I spend in, excuse me, in public transportation, I find myself getting more and more depressed. And it's good that there are studies that show that the longer you spend commuting, the sadder you become. So I go home very upset. But on days where I don't have to do that, I enjoy the convenience of stores being nearby. So I've always kind of just accepted that it's a trade-off that I have to make for living in the city and for wanting that convenience.
I love KL, honestly, and not just because it's a show on our station. I just genuinely do love the capital city, but I don't think that it is the most conducive place for our mental health, generally speaking. I mean, so on one end, I suppose you've got Singapore, which I really can't. And then on the other side, you've got places like Paris, for example. I really enjoy Paris. It's got wide avenues. It's very walkable. It's not the cleanest. It's not the safest, but it's a beautiful city to occupy. And the same goes for somewhere like Kyoto, which is just beautiful. It's history around every corner. Again, it's very, very walkable. So for me, walkability is just hugely important in terms of how happy I am in a space.
Oh, that was Taiwan for me, and how on time their public transport was. Traveling was very easy, and I didn't have to think too much about where to go because help was always on hand. Like, if I didn't know where I wanted to go, someone would be there to immediately assist me the moment I look a bit confused.
Let us know, what cities have you happy, you know? And do you agree that urban planning has a role to play in terms of mental health? When you took a look around KL earlier, how did that make you feel? We want to hear from you. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. We've received a bunch of messages about political debates as well, and we will get to that, but first we are headed to the news. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.